Hello, I am Farha Khan. This is Prof Talk. Today on Prof Talk, Department Head and Professor Daniel Vickers joins me from the Department of History. Dr. Vickers works in the fields of early American, Atlantic, and maritime history. He taught at the Memorial University of Newfoundland for 15 years before moving to the University of California, San Diego in 1999, and then here to UBC in 2006, where he has served as Department Head. His most recent book is entitled Young Men and the Sea, Yankee Seafarers in the Age of Sail. He's also the editor of the Blackwell Companion to Colonial American History and the recent autobiography of Ashley Bowen. He joins me now live in the CITR studio. Welcome, Danny, to Prof Talk.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So can you please provide us a brief overview of the history department here at UBC? What kinds of programs do you offer? What areas of study are represented in the department?
Well, we're a pretty big department by Canadian standards. We cover virtually all types of history, all periods of history, although really not in the classical period. That's handled by classical Near Eastern religious studies. But from the medieval period onwards, we try to do it all. Not all equally well, but we try to do it all.
Right. And what programs do you offer?
We have a bachelor's program, well-regarded honors programs, probably the most intensive honors history program in North America. We have a master's, a doctoral program. Doctoral program, again, covers lots of different areas, but our strongest fields are indigenous history, East Asian history, Canadian history generally, perhaps maritime history, that covers most of it. Yeah, history of science, yes, we have a strong program there too.
Can you also sort of expand on the honors program? Because I've heard that as well. Why is it so unique?
Well, for many years, I mean, it was like going to graduate school at the end of your second year. It was very competitive to get into. And once you arrived in it, once you were accepted, you basically stopped taking any courses in groups larger than about six or seven. So it's very intense, a very small group. All the writing assignments were lengthy, and of course, all the students knew each other extremely well. So it was like going to graduate school only after your second year. Problem with it was that we poured so much resources into it that we weren't able to deliver anything like the same sort of program to our undergraduates. And I think we decided about five, 6 years ago that it was time to redress the balance a little. And so now we have a much more intensive majors program with much more small group engagement. But even with the resources removed from the honors programs, it's still, in terms of contact and specialized courses and sort of general student-professor engagement, I just don't know of another program, at least at a public university. I mean, one of the things that you have to realize about UBC and when you're comparing it to other places is that we are a huge public university, one of the largest in North America. And, you know, whatever achievements different departments make, they're making against a lot of difficult hurdles generated basically by numbers. And so it's. I'm sure that if you went to Princeton or Vassar or Stanford, you'd get a more intensive undergraduate education. But I don't think you would do much better at a large public university anywhere that I know of on this continent.
Mm-hmm. So you think programs like the Honors Program really makes the experience of undergraduate education a little bit better and more intimate?
I think it's. I do. I also think the Majors Program is quite unusual, and we do things in my department here that when I tell other heads of departments that I meet at conferences or wherever around North America about it, they don't believe it. Mm. They don't believe that history professors are willing to do things, are interested to do things, and want to do things that they are, because they just don't happen elsewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell you what some of those are if you're interested.
Yeah, tell us.
Well, I mean, for one thing, there's a habit in large research universities to turn graduate students into graders. Mm-hmm. The purpose of that is to free up professors from grading time so they can do more research. Well, that's not a terrible objective, but it basically takes professors out of any classroom time except large lectures. In the history department here, we have no graders. Every person, graduate student, runs a discussion sections and grades them as well, but actually has to teach students directly in small groups. If you're a professor and you get a teaching assistant, well, that's great. You have some help with your work, but you have to take on a discussion section of your own. Mm-hmm. So every single professor in the history department teaches discussion sections alongside, of course, our graduate students. Our professors agreed to teach all our fourth-year research seminars, these sort of capstone seminars are now common throughout the Faculty of Arts, mm-hmm. in duplicate. In other words, we teach them twice every week, which means that instead of meeting together in a group of 24, they meet together in groups of 12 and for 2 hours each. So they're effectively teaching overtime in order to provide students with a small group environment. And that matters in seminars because, you know, there are lots of things you can do in 24 that you can do in 12, but one thing you can't do is you can't present papers to each other. It's too clumsy with 24 people. There wouldn't be enough hours to do it properly, but divide them up in two, you can. And that adds a huge dimension. I just had one class like that this morning. I teach one of these. And just sitting back and watching the students talk to each other, well, I don't even have to be present, but they're not talking through me the mm-hmm. way they do if they don't know each other. Mm-hmm. It's really wonderful. I mean, it's very, very moving when you think about it.
Yes. So the students are obviously responding to this type of teaching. What are they telling you, and what are history students telling you in the department?
Well, they have a vested interest in telling me that it's all right, right? Because I run the place, so I'm not sure I'm the one to trust on this matter. I do know that when their external review committee came through this year, they said they were. The three professors, one from UCLA, one from Minnesota, one from McGill, told us at the end that they were humbled by the enthusiasm that our undergraduates showed towards the program, and that the undergraduates felt that we showed towards the program. That was the actual word they used, humbled. Mm-hmm. It's their word, not mine. But we do other things, too. This is another thing I've never heard of elsewhere. Every year we run a town hall where we invite all the undergraduate majors into a classroom to criticize us, to criticize the program. You know, not personally individual professors, but what we do wrong, what we are thinking of getting rid of and shouldn't, what we haven't yet provided and should, where our program is weak, where our program is strong. And what that means is that students and professors are willing to talk about teaching in ways that I haven't encountered at other research universities. When I went down to, before I taught here, I taught at the University of California, San Diego. Good university and some good teachers there. I'm very fond of the people, the place. But when I went for my interview there, no one asked me a single, not one question about teaching. Not one. And I asked them why afterwards, and they said, well, that would send the wrong signal. And I thought for a minute, and said, well, you know, what they meant by that is that a place that takes undergraduate teaching seriously is not a serious institution, not a serious world-class university. And I thought to myself, I don't really care whether they're right or wrong in their eyes. It's wrong in my eyes. It just is. And I don't think, furthermore, that it's necessarily the true. And I don't even think it's particular to the history department at UBC. I think UBC generally is a more undergraduate-centered institution than certainly UC San Diego was.
Now, before we began, we were having a discussion outside about what you tell students that are finishing their second year and they're about to, you know, declare a major, about what history is and why study history. What do you tell them?
Well, I'm a historian of the dim and distant past, right? So the immediate relevance of colonial American history of the 16th and the 17th and the 18th centuries may not be immediately obvious. But I think that, in fact, it is relevant. It is relevant in this sense. Historians are not the only people who study the past. Almost everyone in this arts faculty, social science and humanities, in some sense, studies things that have happened. But the difference between historians and the rest of them is that we study things in their entire context. I sometimes worry that we're jacks of all trades and masters of none. I mean, we know a little economic theory, a little critical theory, a little linguistic theory, what have you, but there is no historical theory, or at least there is. It's not a very high degree of abstraction. But we do know the world in which the subjects that we study lived. We know about their economic behavior. We know about their spiritual behavior. We know about their sexual behavior, at least something about it. We know about their lives, right? And that now enables us to see them better, I think, than other people, than people who focus simply in on one aspect of their lives. It's a more holistic view. And that's important because it gives you a perspective on the present. The one thing I tell the students when we talk to them, and we just did it last week, that there's one thing you can be absolutely certain of. It's that everything that we think is normal and natural and the way it is now will have disappeared in 500 years. Just like everything that people 500 years ago thought, or at least a huge amount of it, has disappeared now. And that's, I think, a very important lesson in the non-naturalness of human institutions and human culture, and that things just change. And that the things that we think are right are not necessarily going to seem right 100 years from now. And I think that teaches a type of humility and a type of self-awareness that is sort of history's thing. And I think for that reason alone, it's worth studying. And of course, if you're interested in, if you look upon history in that fashion, then it doesn't matter how far back you go. The further back you go, the bigger the changes, the more perspective you have on the modern condition. So I'm an unashamed early modern historian.
So if you have a student that is trying to debate between, saying, graduate studies in interdisciplinary studies at UBC or, say, history, what would you tell that student?
I would say that history is inherently interdisciplinary, in that you simply can't be a good historian if you don't know something about economics and something about religion and something about literature and something about philosophy. It's just not possible. At the same time, I mean, I respect those other disciplines because I do understand that my grasp on, say, economics is can't compete with that of somebody in the economics department. When I've given papers in the economics department, we often talk a little across purposes, I still feel I have something to offer them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to be completing your term as head of the department in the next month or so?
June 30th.
A few months from now. What will you be doing in the Department of History following that?
Well, I'm going to take an administrative leave of 1 year. I've been running two different departments, one in San Diego and one here, for 8 years now. So except for the 2 days in the middle on which I was on board a train from San Diego to Vancouver, I need a holiday, or at least a break from pushing Excel spreadsheets around. And I also have a book I have to finish. Okay. On the history of borrowing and lending in early America. And then it's back to being a professor.
So you'll continue teaching in the department. Can you tell us about your book?
Well, it's based on an interest I have in trying to find out whether or not people in the past, understood economic obligations differently from the way we do today. Mm. Like the conventional wisdom is that people always deal with each other when they're dealing economically as individuals, whether they bargain and haggle or give and receive, that they deal with each other as individuals. And I'm curious about what the rules of giving and receiving, of borrowing and lending are, particularly in a world as early, my field of early American history, where there was so little money about, so that people didn't actually buy things in the way we do with written obligations like and credit cards or cash. They simply delivered things to other people and received things from other people, and one way or another sort of kept track of it all. And it seems to me that that's not how we behave now, and it has with it all sorts of implications. And so that's sort of what I explore.
Was it based on trust? What was the system?
I think it was actually based on, it depended a bit on what they were doing. That when they were dealing in things that were regarded as commodities, like land or fish on the east coast of North America, then it was not too much different from the way we do. But there were lots of things, I think, that were negotiated back then that you didn't really feel necessarily had to be strictly repaid. So that the unit of accounting for these people was not between individuals, but within entire communities. So there would be some people with whom you would constantly run a surplus. You know, you'd always be taking in more than you gave out. But with other people, it'd be the reverse. And so long as you sort of felt that you were, in a broader scheme of things, generally in balance around your kid, that you were just being screwed over constantly, you're relatively content. So the belief that things had to be this for that, I don't think existed as much. That's one thing. The other thing is that our dealings in the modern day are mainly with people we never meet, mm-hmm. right? Nowadays they're even done online, so you don't even meet the. You don't even have to confront them face to face. It's not a question whether you know them or not. You just don't even know who they are. And the vast majority of dealings in early America were with people you knew. And that meant that they had elements to them that were personal, that had to do with their character, had to do with their family, had to do with whether you were going to marry their daughter or not. I mean, there are lots of issues of that aren't an issue when you stare at your visa bill, and I think that our economic significant others now are institutions, and their economic significant others were all people, and that to me is an enormous difference.
Now, this is a bit of a shift from your previous research, if I'm not mistaken.
I've always been interested in credit.
Oh, okay.
My first book was about fishermen. It's called Farmers and Fishermen. But the fishing part of it was about fishermen who basically were outfitted on credit, and merchants used credit to manipulate fishermen. Same is true with whaling merchants and whalemen. And so that was a maritime interest of mine. I think what I've discovered as I come back to this is that credit's a little more complicated than I thought it was. It certainly is a form of coercion, but it can also be emblematic of all sorts of other things: cooperation, deference, lots of things. And so it's. It stems from an old interest of mine, but it's a different spin on it.
What initially brought you to studying the field of history?
There's never been a time in my life when I wasn't more interested in old things than I am in new. When I was a little boy, I used to go down to the basement of our house, and I'd just dig through old cardboard boxes and stuff and look for just old older letters, just things that are old. But I walk down the street and I see a whole pile of Harley Davidsons, but one's obviously from the 50s or 60s. That's where my eye turns. Mm-hmm. It's irrational.
It's been with you for a long time.
It's just the way I am.
Great. What do you think is the most or the most challenging issue facing young students at a public university like UBC?
Well, I mean, let me answer that in terms of what's changed since I was in. I went to a big public university too, the University of Toronto. I graduated in 1971. There are just huge differences. For one thing, I graduated debt-free. Present wife and earned enough in her summer job to pay all her expenses. And I did almost enough, though I had to take some money from my parents. So that's one big difference. Because you could earn enough money in the summer, you didn't have to work part-time. Right? Most people, you know, they had full loads. They may have had small outside jobs, but not major ones. Everyone knew what year they were in. You know, first year, second year, third year, fourth year. The notion of being sort of, you know, a transcript had just had a straight 5 for 10, depending if it was a year long or half year courses every year. And so that's a big difference. Another big difference was that classes were smaller. When I was an undergraduate, I took four, at a big, big university, I took 4 full year research seminars. Which meant when I graduated, I had 4 professors who could write detailed letters of reference for me. I'd written a good number of papers. There were 20, 25, 30. It was like being in the honors program a little here. Only back then, I was just a major. So that's a second big difference and something that people have to face now.
Well, it has been a real pleasure speaking with you this afternoon, and it goes by quickly, doesn't it? Yes. And I wish you the best of luck with your year off that's mm-hmm. forthcoming, and your book. Your maybe we'll have you back on the show when you've completed that project.
Oh, I look forward to it. It's been nice talking to you.
Yeah, it's been great. You're listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. I've just been speaking with Professor Daniel Vickers from the Department of History. If you would like to learn more about his department, please visit www.history.ubc.ca. In 2 weeks, I will speak with Dr. Jerry Marquette. He's a clinical professor from the Division of Obstetrics and Gynecology in the UBC Faculty of Medicine. Dr. Marquette will provide an overview of the clinical field of perinatology. If you would like to hear a podcast of this show or any previous episode of Prof Talk, you can visit citr.ca. And please do check out our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. In June, our new website will be launched, and the address of that website is proftalk.ubc.ca. You can also email us at prof.talk@ubc.ca. I'd like to end today's show with some music from Newfoundland. The track is titled If Old Boats Could Talk. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for listening today.
Out from the shore where the land meets the sea, rocks are piled up where the wharves used to be. Some still in their cradle defying the waves, preserve a creation that our forefathers made. On the beach lies the hull of an old fishing boat. It's been quite a while since that skiff was afloat. Aged by the weather and bleached by the sun, its work days all over and a long rest begun. And if old boats could talk, what a tale they would tell of the brothers, the sons, and the fathers. Carved in into time with a tear for each line shed by the mothers and daughters of the brave men who sailed on the waters. There's a broken propeller and a flywheel nearby, wedged in the sand from the wind and the tide. An old yellow dory washed up on the shore that never will sail those blue waters no more. And if all boats could talk, what a tale they would tell of the brothers, the sons, and the fathers. Carved into time with a tear for each line shed by the mothers and daughters of the brave men who sailed on the waters. Relics collected from the people around build a Bayside museum in our sleepy town. There's pictures and posters of all things that float, from great ocean freighters to small fishing boats. And if old boats could talk, what a tale they would tell of the brothers, the sons, and the fathers. Carved into time with a tear for each line shed by the mothers and daughters of the brave men who sailed on the waters. Those brave men who sailed on the waters. Those brave men who sailed on the waters. Those brave men who sailed on the waters.
Georgia Strait, CITR 101.9 FM, Boutique Empire, and the Biltmore Cabaret are proud to present the Sex with Strangers CD release party, Thursday, April 14th. Local legends Sex with Strangers want to celebrate their latest release, Frontier Justice, with you. Yes, you. Joining in the party will be Run with the Herd and Joyce Collingwood, plus the world premiere of The Controlling Boyfriends and DJ sets by Guilty About Girls. How, oh how can I be a part of this, you're wondering? Well, advance tickets are available at Zulu, Red Cat, Neptune, and online at ticketweb.ca. Doors at 8, show at 9. Don't miss the Sex with Strangers CD release party, Thursday, April 14th at the Biltmore Cabaret.
Bipolar disorder? Are you creative? If so, you are invited to participate on April 1st in an inspiring day of presentations by top bipolar researchers on the link between bipolar disorder and creativity. Help us answer the question, what does creativity mean to you? CRESBD is also sponsoring two evening events which are open to the public. On Thursday, March 31st at the Goldcore Center for the Arts, CRESBD presents a screening of three films about creativity and mental health. On Friday, April 1st at 8 p.m., come dance the night away at the Chapel Arts Center for The Creative Life, a night of music celebrating bipolar disorder, featuring members of the New Pornographers, Shane Turner Overdrive, and Vancouver Nights. For full details on this two-day event and how to register, please visit www.crestbd.ca.